from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on the Forum program, poet Kay Ryan built her career out of writing simple, clean lines free of flourishes and fanfare. She self-published her first book at the age of 40 before being named U.S. Poet Laureate 25 years later. The Marin resident and Pulitzer Prize winner talks with us about her new collection, Erratic Facts, and where she finds inspiration. It's coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Bay Area-based poet and teacher Kay Ryan joins us for the second Forum Hour, a recipient of the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry and the National Humanities Medal. She served twice as the nation's poet laureate, and she's currently a MacArthur Fellow and author of a new collection titled Erratic Facts. And we welcome her back to the Forum program. Good to see you.
Pleasure to be here.
Boy, we were talking a little bit about before we went on there, the fact that you got racked up pretty badly on one of your bicycle trips. And I know you've done a lot of bicycling, including a 4K-mile bike ride over 80 days across the United States. In the promo to this hour, I said, well, find out maybe what inspires her. Does bike riding inspire you?
I would say that bike riding adjusts me in a way that – you know how you have to have your machine in good running order in order to work. It adjusts my equipment, I would say.
And gives you time to think.
It gives me time to not think. I need great quantities of time to do no thinking. So I do some of that on my bike. Of course, it requires more time than that, but that's very good not thinking time.
Well, congratulations on this new collection of thinking time that came into fruition in this new book of poetry that you've published. A lot of this has to do with loss of your partner, Carol Ardair. And in many respects, in fact, I noticed the dedication was to her and said, anyhow. And you want to explain that?
It seems pretty clear if she's not alive. I can't directly dedicate it to her. She can't receive it. But I was not stopped by that. I just decided to dedicate it to her anyhow.
How's
because
it been?
It still is dedicated to her.
I mean, you've been in grief. How's it been?
Well, I think we use those words so constantly and sort of automatically that I am not really sure that I even know what the words grief or loss represent. One enters a new condition. I haven't entered a condition in which there isn't any Carol anymore. And everything I do is in that condition. And what I write is predicated upon that knowledge and physical reality. But it isn't necessarily, you know, I still eat popcorn, you know, and do regular things. And it's
buttered popcorn or just plain?
No, I still don't eat buttered popcorn, but I still eat popcorn. Everything goes on, you know, and I think about other things. And I don't consider myself in a state of grief. I consider myself in a state of unfixable loss.
It's a good way to put it. And you still have your spirit and you still have your verve about you, and I'm glad to see all that. I want to talk about this new collection, but erratic, you know, I didn't think of it in a geological sense when I saw the title.
I love thinking of it that way. Have you been to Yosemite?
Yes.
Okay. Have you been to the high country where there are all the erratics?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So erratics are rocks that are deposited. Well, rock isn't a sufficiently grand term for it. Generally, immense chunks of stone ground down inside glaciers and eventually melted out in new locations that have nothing geologically to do. You know, the rock is an alien rock. It came from far away and arrived over many eons. Maybe one eon. I don't know how long an eon is.
It's a long time. There's a title poem, in fact, Erratic Facts, which I want to talk to you about some of these poems specifically. By the way, I'm interested to know what you have to say about this. We just did a massive survey of our listeners, and some of them kind of took potshots at poetry being a topic for discussion, which kind of hurt me and might hurt you since we both love poetry and you write it and everything. What do you say to those naysayers about poetry?
You know, I don't even talk to them. They are really uninteresting to me. The entire conversation just makes me fantastically impatient. I think poetry, I am blithely optimistic about the fortunes of poetry because it can't be stopped. It's as permanent as a coin lost in the couch. You know, whenever that coin's found, it is valuable. It's something which retains its own value, and it doesn't require the good opinion of others.
Well, I always think about Marianne Moore. I too dislike it, but then she goes on to talk about how valuable it is. And
well, you know, most of what it passes for poetry is not going to be. I mean, anyone can say they're writing it, including myself, and that doesn't prove us right, but poetry endures. It endures, and it is that to which we turn when we are too impatient or too needy in some way for anything less, and we know it and turn to it. Happens every time.
I certainly do. I'm turning to one of your poems now, actually. And self-interest here, perhaps, but you write a poem about Thelonious Monk and begin with a quote from NPR.
Mm-hmm. I was going to read that one today.
All right, so why don't you?
Oh, okay, why don't I?
It's called Monk Style. And I'll just read the quote from NPR. In practice, it took 45 minutes to get his stride. It was hard for Monk to play Monk. Right out of NPR.
Yes, I was listening to NPR, and I just loved it. I've been inspired repeatedly by what I heard on NPR. So, yeah, here it is. It may be that Monk is always playing Monk, but down the hall, there are long corridors, as in a school. Monk must approach himself, join himself at the bench, and sit a while. Then slip his hands into his hands, Monk style.
Yeah, that's really a terrific poem. I mean, it captures so much about Thelonious Monk that, you know, is at the heart of what he did and what he continues to do in an enduring way. You introduced me to W.G. Sebald in this collection of poetry, who is a writer, a German writer I had no knowledge of, but feel like I should. There are a couple of your poems, in fact, that use quotes of his.
Sebald, he's a real favorite of mine. He's no longer alive, I'm very sorry to say, but he is a most mysterious and elegant and melancholy writer. You can't really say that he's a novelist or exactly an essayist or a writer of travel books, but his work is wonderfully hypnotic and elusive. I'm sorry that I'm sounding elusive myself, but you really do have to read Sebald to understand.
Right. You've inspired me to do so. So, also, in this new collection, there's a poem which is an homage to Joseph Brodsky, who is a poet I've always admired, and I presume you as well from the poem. And it's funny to me that I can see parallels, actually, suddenly, in your work in Brodsky's. I don't know if you see them, but it occurred to me in this new collection, at least. And yet, when people talk about your poetry, they often compare you, mostly, I think, to American poets, obviously, to Emily Dickinson, certainly very flattering, and Robert Frost. Reminds me of, you know, the old Paul Simon song, "You read your Emily Dickinson and I my Robert Frost."
But, well, or you can read me.
Or you can read Kay
Ryan.
Either
one, right?
So your influences, who are your main influences?
You know, that's a really hard thing to say. I think I notice relationships retroactively. In other words, I have, in a sense, done the writing, and then I go, "Ooh, yeah, I can see that she and I, or he and I, are fascinated by some of the same things and trying some of the same things." But I would say that most of my influences are unavailable to me. I'm kind of sui generis.
She says modestly. And well, when you said "she and I," though, I was struck by that because I remember, I'm sure you're familiar with Adrienne Rich writing about how she had to find her own female voice. She had to find the voice that was not dictated to her by Wallace Stevens or Robert Frost or these male poets. Kay Ryan, go through some of that?
Well, you know, I had to get over myself. When I first started writing, which was, say, after the age of about 30, I started taking it seriously. I had to get over wanting to be a public self. I had to get over being an entertainer, amusing, that sort of thing. You know, settling for that in verse, because if you're going to write poetry, you really have to hit all the notes on the keyboard, and you have to go beyond the amusing or narrative.
That'd be like Monk, huh?
Well, I there are a lot of ways to do it, but you know, I'd like to go back to that Monk poem for a second. It interests me a great deal to think that the creative part, say, of Monk or of anybody who is creative, is that part is always sort of off someplace working on it. But the person here is really sometimes very far away from that one, and that it is a very slow approach. But it's, to me, it's very, very consoling to think that maybe old Monk, you know, Monk's working away, and the public Monk just has to go sit down with him and put his hands in there, and he can start doing it.
How much do you feel that divide now, especially with all this glory of a Pulitzer Prize and twice Poet Laureate and a MacArthur, of the public Kay Ryan and the private Kay Ryan?
Well, all of the things that you just enumerated feel like they feel like somebody else, you know, like a thing that's said, and I feel sort of embarrassed when this long string of things are said, because they do feel very remote, and I feel, in fact, quite unaffected by them.
Well, for so long you were just an ordinary composition teacher at College of Marin. In fact,
really a long time. Yeah.
Miss it? You miss teaching composition?
Not at all.
I would have assumed that answer. Yeah. Actually, one of the poems, I want to hear some more of the poems. I think I want my listeners to hear them too. But you evoke the magical name of Lawrence Stern. So it's not just...
But who evoked that?
You did.
Oh, I did?
Yeah, from the life and fiction of Lawrence Stern.
Oh, I see. But you didn't mention that yet.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you read a lot of novels too?
No, I hardly read any novels. I read murder mysteries, however.
That's it. Yeah. Mainly.
I mean, I guess we could call those novels.
Then... I'll go back with you, in fact, to talk about how this public person came into being and everything. There was a big piece on it in The New Yorker. And but Dana Gioia was a big figure in this. I knew him back in the day. Don't hear from him much these days. I don't know what he's doing. You know, he had kind of a glory period himself of public, not so much acclaim. He was in a position thanks to Laura Bush in the Bush administration. But he kind of vaulted you in many ways, didn't he, into this career such as it is?
You mean in the public, public sense?
Yeah.
Dana was very important in that. He noticed my work early and got in touch with me, and he did everything he could. And he is a person of great influence, and he used that influence to help me where he could. And I'm extremely grateful to him for having done that.
When Robert Hass, also a local, was poet laureate, we've got a little bit of a monopoly here, you know, in terms of Bay Area poets being crowned.
I'm afraid we've kind of used up Marin County.
Yeah, I think so. there was some sense that, I mean, he did. He changed that whole role to be an educator and to, you know, bring poetry into the schools more and all that sort of thing. You followed through on that, didn't you?
No, I didn't. I was sort of a caretaker poet laureate.
A sui generis caretaker poet.
I was a lame duck from the first day.
Oh, you and Obama. let's have you read another poem or two, if you wouldn't mind. I like so many of these poems, it's hard for me to. Why don't you choose one?
All right. I'll read a little poem.
As we say in radio, set it up for us. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to set this up for you. I'm going to read a little poem called, you know, I should never bother to say little poem because they're all fairly brief. This is a poem. It's called New Rooms. And I'm a reluctant traveler, but I found myself in Italy in a castle, actually, and with nothing to do but write. And I had no expectation that I would write because I don't really like encouragement, you know. It was all entirely too encouraging and designed to produce the perfect circumstances for writing. But nonetheless, I did write. And I'm always trying to figure out how the brain works or what are its happy conditions. So this is about the mind. The mind must set itself up wherever it goes, and it would be most convenient to impose its old rooms. Just tack them up like an interior tent. Oh, but the new halls aren't where the windows went.
Well, so you did get encouraged.
Well, you know, I think we would like to just take our old brain with us, you know, and not change, and use our old assumptions and our old expectations of where the good bread store is going to be. But everything's in the wrong position.
That's why people go to Hawaii, I think, isn't it?
to have new rooms or no rooms?
Have no rooms, yeah. Just to veg out, as they say. Actually, that poem reminded me of a statement right in the flap of the book here, of your new book, Erratic Facts. There are poets who begin with ideas and draw life in toward their speculations. Kay Ryan is this latter sort of artist. She starts with details, oddities, categories, then unscrews and rebolts them, magnetizes them so that in turn they draw all the bright filings the world throws out. That's pretty good, isn't it?
I really like it. That was Sandy McClatchy. Really beautiful.
I mean, it kind of sums up a lot of what you do and how you do it, too. And what makes this... I've been reading some of the reviews of this book, and some are saying it's different, it's more daring, for example, as one reviewer said.
Hmm.
Is this more daring from your perspective? Or different? And how is it different?
I don't know that I'm ever the one. I don't know if the author's the one to answer those questions. But to me, of course, one difference and one thing that made the book rather difficult to put together was that it does have the great blast of of loss in the middle. And I tend to be very disinterested in biography, autobiography, being read biographically, and yet there is a great deal of attempting to cope with a blast or loss or disorder or the fragmentation of the mind, and I didn't want those things to be personal. I mean, they have a personal origin, of course, but I don't think that's enough to make them interesting as poems. And it isn't necessary for anybody to know that about my life. I don't even want my life to be important in it. But they are grappling probably with more desperate material than sometimes, and perhaps they're less fun. And that sort of bothered me. I felt kind of apologetic about maybe a low fun level. I wouldn't get a good fun score on this book.
Oh, you're a lot of fun to read, though, in spite of that. You want to read one of those poems? I mean, the Blast poems?
Yes, I do. How about I read one called Blast? This is fantastic, the segues we're making.
Cool.
Blast. The holes have almost left the sky, and the blank, and let me start again. The holes have almost left the sky, and the blanks the paths. The patches next to natural, corroborated by the incidental sounds of practical activities and crows, themselves exhibiting many of the earmarks of the actual. This must have happened many times before, we must suppose. Almost a pulse, if we could speed it up. The repeated seeking of our several senses toward each other, fibers trying to reach across the gap as fast as possible following a blast.
You read that with a lot of, what I would almost characterize as personal feeling, that you seems to distinguish a poem like that, too, even though you want yourself out of that poem or you don't want to necessarily put yourself into that
Well,
poem.
I'll tell you. Listen, I read this a couple of years ago in Boston following the terrible...
the marathon killings?
Killings, yeah. There. It was shortly after that, and it seemed absolutely as though I had written it for them.
Understood.
So it doesn't have to be personal.
You hear what is playing here, Kay?
Yes, that's the blast music.
Yeah, that's Thelonious Monk around midnight. Join us with Kay Ryan. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. Or post questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum. I'd like to hear from listeners when we have somebody of Kay Ryan's stature. What poets do you love? What poems do you love? And if you have questions or comments for her or reactions to the poems you've heard, we'd like to hear from you, too. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're talking with poet Kay Ryan, who explores love, loss, and the passing of time in a new collection called Erratic Facts, about 60-some poems, emblematic poems for her. She's built a career out of writing, I suppose, what you could call simple, clean lines, free of flourishes and fanfare, and self-published her first book at the age of 40, before being named U.S. Poet Laureate 25 years later. She's a Marin resident. She's also a Pulitzer Prize winner. And we're talking about the new collection, Erratic Facts, and also talking with you, the listeners, about Kay's poems and poetry, and also about poetry that particularly has moved you or has maybe been there when you needed the poem, as I like to think of poetry, or continues to maybe even stay in your consciousness in some form. Always interested in hearing poetry and poems that listeners like or love. And you can join us on this program at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. K Kay Ryan will be appearing at Book Passage in Corte Madera tonight at 7 o'clock, and she'll also appear at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley on Thursday, October 22nd at 7:30. And let's go to our callers. Kate, join us. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for the opportunity. I want to tell Ms. Ryan a little story about her poem, We're Building the Ship as We're Sailing. And I have a board, and we were struggling mightily during one meeting. Somebody brought that poem, read it, and it gave us hope that we could reinvent ourselves and be successful.
And that you just simply have to do it that way, right? There's no help for it.
Well, and if you don't acknowledge it, that's what you're doing, lying to yourself and others.
Well, I'm glad it was a help.
It was a tremendous help. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that, Kate. In fact, looking at a website comment from Kenneth, who says, the last time Kay Ryan was on forum, she told me that she does not always know where a poem will end when she starts one. And since I have found that the same is true of life, I really love her work.
Well, you know, that's absolutely true. I mean, if you knew where it was going to end when you started it, why would you bother to start it?
Wouldn't be fun, right? Or you wouldn't learn as you learn from your poetry.
I mean, Frost said there has to be surprise in it. And if there isn't surprise for the writer, there can't be surprise for the reader.
You've also said from time to time, like you just said, biography shouldn't be an important part and everything. But I always read Lifetime Californian. It's like in a positive next to your name. and living in California your whole life has obviously certainly colored your poetry in great ways, in dramatic ways, I would think.
I didn't really notice that I was a Californian until I became laureate and traveled around the country a lot, because I'm not much of a traveler. So, like, fish don't really notice that they're fish until you take them out of the water. Yeah. I got a really strong sense of being a Californian, being a Westerner particularly. All those things should say lifetime Westerner. So now I run around cowboy boots, you know, and I didn't before, but I feel much more Western. I think I'm going to get a bolo tie.
Here's Bella who writes, Michael, you can talk about poetry any day as far as I'm concerned. Thank you, Bella. It's always good to hear those kinds of comments. You like talking about poetry?
No. No.
It does take something away, doesn't it?
Well, I hope that it doesn't take anything away. I always feel that I always feel like I have mittens on, you know, that I'm trying to do something very fine with maybe thick rubber safety. Ooh. Yellow safety gloves.
Or those kitchen
massive
gloves.
Ones.
Yeah,
yes.
Big ones,
yes.
Like the kitchen. Yeah. But people often ask you to explain your poems, don't they?
I don't talk to people a lot, so no, they don't.
Sort of the hermit role seems to suit you in some ways.
Well, I don't think of it as a role.
It's you.
I don't like the idea of, you know, personas and roles. I think, you know, just be what you are.
Well, it speaks volumes of who you are and also of your poetry, certainly. And I had said earlier, I was talking about inspiration and bicycle riding. And what does inspire you? We were kind of promoting the program on, we'll find out what inspires her.
Well, here I am to tell you. I would say that what I like to do is find those things which put my brain in a condition to simply engage with itself and find what in it sticks to what else in it. But what does that for me is often reading the hyper-intelligent essays of people like Brodsky. See, I love Brodsky's essays. I love...
More than his poetry?
I really can't really read his poetry. I'm sure that it's fantastic in Russian. I have every reason to believe that, you know, given everything else about him. But it's not really available to me to enjoy in English. But I like to read essays.
Who else?
George Steiner is really thrilling. Yeah. I love to read. I always read Walter Benjamin, even though I don't pronounce his name properly. I've Calvino is a perennial favorite. Those are some.
You don't read Calvino's fiction, just his essays?
Just his essays, yeah.
Bring another caller on, and that's you, Shema. Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask, Kay, what advice do you have for poets about, you know, getting into publishing, about the great struggle that is all kinds of creative writing, and about going out into the world to find experiences and insights to write about and write from?
Gee, that's a lot of questions. which one would you really like to know about?
I think just advice about creative writing, because it's really a struggle, and I'm wondering how you deal with that.
How to do it, or how to promote it, or
I guess how to keep at it, because I feel like there's, you know, everybody's experience is different, but sort of going forward and editing and continuing to have the courage to writing is quite a struggle, and I'm wondering how you deal with it.
Well, you do have to have quite an appetite for frustration. Or if not an appetite, that suggests an
appetite,
eagerness.
Right.
I don't think you don't have to actually have an appetite for it, but you have to have a stomach for it, shall we say. You have to be able to tolerate a lot of frustration, and you have to be more patient than you ever wanted to be. But I would say that one of the great impediments now is just expecting results much too quickly. I think you need to expect to be an apprentice or to apprentice yourself to yourself for years in order to even figure out what it is that you want to do. And you mostly find that out by becoming sort of disenchanted with what you have been doing and desperately trying something else. I would say it's a condition of progressive desperations.
You went through 25 years of, I suppose, what could be called progressive desperation, or certainly not being recognized as was your due. When you did get the recognition, was there a feeling of, well, I finally showed them, or any of that kind of vindication feeling?
Yes.
Okay. Can you read another poem for us? I was thinking about a couple of poems here that I like. This poem, Almost. I like the poem. So let me let you choose between three that I was going to.
Well, great. Now tell me what page they're on.
Almost is on page 46.
Okay.
But I also like why it's, because we were kind of intimating this a little bit, why it's hard to start, which is on 34, and what I call the King Richard III poem on. That's my title, not yours, on 37, Kingdom for the Horse.
Oh, let me read that one. I really want to read that one, okay?
Yeah, good.
Okay, this is My Kingdom for a Horse, and of course that comes from Shakespeare.
Right? Richard III.
Richard III, thank you. I knew you'd know. Here we go. Your kingdom has already grown abstract. No one with an actual kingdom suggests a trade like that. It can, of course, have been so rapid that you still don't know. We have to hope your voice will prove the final property to go. Of the ancestral timber, the last redoubt, still ringing of your great estates, the lowliest page of any one of which would race to get a horse to get you out.
Yeah, I really like that poem, and so do you. Why do you like that poem?
I like it because the snickersnack is flashing so brilliantly.
Snickersnack.
I like it. I like it because it jams along and because it's so desperate. It's so desperate. And I like saying redoubt and rhyming it with get you out.
Daring. That's the right word again. That was kind of rhyme.
You know, you can't often work redoubt into a contemporary poem. Although I'm not claiming that these are really all that contemporary, except by having been published this year.
When we were kids, we used to, you know, I'll bet you can't find anything that rhymes with orange. I mean, there are words like that.
Sure. Well, there's borange or corange or lorange.
See, on the spot.
Those are new, though. You know?
Well, you're inventing words. That's good. Let me go to Oakland and welcome Steve. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. Ms. Ryan, I'm a little bit over my head here, but I, first of all, I haven't read your stuff, but I have a friend, I read poetry, and a friend who's a big poetry reader, and I want to get her a copy of Erratic Facts. But really what my question is the poem, you know, we all have our favorites. You know, I like Whitman, but when I was 17, I was in a lit class and fell out of my seat when Proof Rock was read in the class. And on a recent trip, I picked up a criticism of The Wasteland by Nancy Gish. It was an accident at a used bookstore, and I certainly have needed help in kind of getting through The Wasteland over the years. Believe me, it's many years since you know, I was in high school in the Proof Rock reading. What my question is at the end of her essay on The Wasteland, she goes into Eliot using allusion. And you know better than me how much, you know, the annotation, the footnotes to Wasteland takes up. And I'm just, an average reader. I'm not going to spend a lot of time other than, you know, what has come my way to see allusions in The Wasteland.
That's allusion with an A, we should specify.
Yes, with an A, yes. my question to you is, when you write your poetry, do you... Eliot evidently was very conscious of using allusion, was not afraid of borrowing from here and there. And I was wondering, in your process, do you consider that, or in listening to you on air?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think I can answer your question right now. I spent a long time as a teacher of basic English skills, and in doing that, I was made aware of how few assumptions you can make about another person's understanding, the illusions that they will get if you use them. We certainly see that with young people who have their own language based on associations that we know nothing about, and it's inscrutable to us. But I am very careful about the allusions to which I the allusions I make, and I think that because of the experience that I've had, I'm very intent upon making the work understandable by an intelligent person without a classical education.
Let me actually put on my English professor hat just for a little bit here, and people. Krasny, you're a pedant, but here we go. Eliot said about The Wasteland, you don't need to understand the allusions. You don't all the footnotes and everything. I think to some extent he was showing off his knowledge, but that's another story. He said the feeling in the poem, particularly that feeling of April being the cruelest month and being unconnected to the land and feeling the sterility mm-hmm. of life and all of that, mm-hmm. lack of love and so forth, that's the real feeling of the poem, and that's to some extent something that can be gleaned from it without all the footnotes, without all the allusions.
Don't get caught in the forest. Huh?
Exactly. Although I keep thinking, as mentioned, Proof Rock, somehow that allusion goes through my head about I grow old, I wear my pants rolled, coming back to me sometimes unbidden. Here are some emails. Let me just read a couple of them. Jeff from Sacramento writes, I love when you have poets on, and I'm enjoying the segment with Miss Ryan tremendously. Sometimes it takes me a moment to relax into these segments while I'm readily at home with more controversial segments, but when I do settle in, I find these conversations restorative. I'm a longtime admirer of Robert Haas ever since deciding that his essential haiku was a treasure worth $25 when I was a restless 17-year-old. And here's Rhoda, who says, I was born and raised and educated in Ireland. I loved our Irish poets, in particular W.B. Yeats and Seamus Heaney. I won medals at school for reciting poetry. However, I never tried writing poetry. Any tips from Kay Ryan on how I might get started?
Modestly.
You mean she should be modest, or you're going to be modest?
Well, I don't know how you start. Maybe you start with something that you've observed, or with an idea that you have that you would like to explore. I don't know if you don't know if you don't sort of have some impulse inside you that is already compelling you to do it. I don't know what it would be.
Something has to ignite, usually, doesn't it? I mean, you can sit down with a blank sheet and try to get words out, but...
Yeah, usually. I mean, I find that a little irritation is particularly useful. Something I sort of like, and I'm not terribly proud of it, but it's pretty deep in my nature. I kind of enjoy disagreeing with something. I'll read an idea by somebody that is very interesting to me, and I will think, now there's a different little angle, or there's something that I want to think about around the corner from that. And so I find that a number of my the things that interest me are kind of in response to something that somebody else has done. Emily Dickinson did that. You know, she has a lot of poems that respond to things in the Bible. She'll talk back. Frost talks back. I think talking back is a good goad. A good motivator.
A good catalyst for poetry, talking right. back. Yeah, I like that. You ever worry or fret or even have any anxiety that the source of your muse or whatever it is maybe not going to be there?
Yes, when I was much younger, I read this phrase, desire dysfunction, that there were some people that suffered from desire dysfunction. And I thought, oh, it would be really terrible to have that happen. And I felt particularly threatened, you know, that I was – my nature was somehow terribly susceptible to ceasing to desire. And so, yeah, I mean, I can imagine stopping wanting. So that would be a terrible thing. I hope it doesn't happen.
It does happen to people, doesn't it? I mean, especially as they get into old age frequently or – sort of give up on life or whatever, lose their vitality. I mean, there's a mystery behind that, isn't it? Is there a mystery behind your poetry?
Well, yes. I mean, there's an essential mystery behind it. I mean, and I don't know what it is, obviously.
It's called creativity, I think, isn't it? Or the impetus to write?
Well, I suppose that's a portion of it.
Yeah. You want to read the title poem? You like the title poem?
It's a difficult poem, and yes, I'm happy to read it. It's, of course, it has an epigraph from, kind of a meaningless epigraph, but it's just something I read. I was reading W.G. Sebald. He's one of the people I like to read in the mornings.
We've been.
No, but he's a little hard. He's sort of poisonous.
sort of.
But he said, it was a very bizarre, erratic fact. And I just loved, I love the idea of erratics. I love those erratics in the Sierras And I wanted to think about erratics. So this is called Erratic Facts. And it's kind of a geologically hopeful poem. Like rocks that just stop, melted out of glaciers, often rounded off, egg-like sometimes, from erasure, as though eggs could really be made backwards, smoothed from something stranded and angular. And let's think it's still early in the work, and later the eggs will quicken to the center.
Yeah, why do you call that poem difficult?
Well, I think to follow what's going on in it is difficult, don't you?
I didn't think so. No, I mean, I think I got it pretty early.
Well, I
on,
think maybe know. I'm just slow.
No. I mean, you didn't intentionally want to make it difficult, did you?
No, certainly not. I sometimes think that what I've done will be hard for someone else to get at what's fascinating me. I mean, it's an extremely fascinating progression of thought there for me. And that's why it's important to me. And sometimes I feel like that'll be a difficult thing to transmit.
Let me transmit some emails here from our listeners. Christine writes, I've been reading the Swedish geographer Gunnar Olsson's magnum opus, Abysmal, which I think Miss Ryan would really enjoy.
Thank you.
Olsson reminds us that Samuel Beckett was James Joyce's secretary and, quote, a genius who dreamed of a writing which is not about something but is that something itself. I think your guest's observation that writing requires patience is spot on with regard to approaching this very high bar set by Beckett. Writers, like musicians, need to set their trajectories in terms of years or decades instead of days or weeks.
Well, hear, hear. I'm with you.
Let's see if what you think about what Christina writes. She says, I'm thoroughly enjoying listening to Kay Ryan and her poetry this morning. Having written poetry for years, listening to Ryan, I'm inspired to pull the best together and put them out there. I'm a Marin County native, born and raised. In response to Michael Krasny's request to hear what other poets his listeners enjoy, I'm a fan of Billy Collins' poetry, T.S. Eliot, and Drew Dellinger. That's quite a triad, isn't it?
It certainly is. Woman of Catholic taste.
You like Billy Collins?
Good friend of mine.
Yeah. But that's not what I asked. Do you like his poetry?
You asked me if I like Billy Collins.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Let me frame that differently. Do you like the poetry of Billy Collins?
I do like the poetry of Billy Collins.
And T.S. Eliot?
I like the poetry of T.S. Eliot.
So you want to name some poetry that you don't like? You read the Stuffed Owl?
Why don't I mention some poetry that I really do like? Somebody who's particularly dear to my heart and not widely read is Stevie Smith, the British poet.
Oh, wonderful poet. But who's Drew Dellinger? I don't know that name. Do you?
I don't know Drew Dellinger.
Okay, we'll have to look her up. Or is it he? I don't know. Drew Dellinger. Do you ever read The Stuffed Owl?
No.
It's a volume of bad poetry.
Mm. Well, I've read many, many, many other chapters of it.
Yeah. And don't you love it when you were a comp teacher and students would say, oh, you're a poet? Can I have you read my poems?
I never told them I was a poet.
You didn't?
No. No, I kept it completely separate.
Huh. But then when you were teaching for a while, when you were starting to get recognition as a poet.
It leaked out a bit.
Yeah.
I always felt that it was important that anybody who wanted to hear the poetry or know something about that would come to it separately on their own. I don't like a coerced or a compelled audience.
But did you have students come and say, here, I'd like you to read my poetry?
Not many. No. I didn't have those kinds of students.
I have two rules on that, which if any lit teachers are listening or creative writing teachers or whatever seem to have put me in good stead through the years. I say, I'll read it, but I'll give you an honest opinion. And remember, I'm just one opinion.
Yeah.
Those are the two provisos.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In many cases, it seems to work. So what's next for you?
Well, I'm going to New York at the end of the month. I'm going to be reading at the 92nd Street Y on November 1st,
which is always
a thrill. I mean, that's Carnegie Hall for our kind of people. and the next night after that, I'm reading at the Noguchi Museum, which is going to be a thrill. I was giving a reading in Stonington, Connecticut this summer, and a woman came up and introduced herself as the director of the Noguchi Museum, and she said, you seem to like rocks. She said, you've written a number of things that have rocks in them. I said, I have. And she said, would you like to come to the Noguchi Museum and read poems about rocks or, you know, that have rock references or connected in some way? And I said, I would really enjoy doing that.
We have a producer named Noguchi, Irene Noguchi.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There's in this new collection, again, I told you I read some of the reviews, and some of them said there's wisdom rather than mystery. Like, mystery used to be a hallmark of your previous work, and now you've moved into a realm more of wisdom. Does that make sense to you?
No.
It doesn't to me either, so I'm glad that I was able to fob that off and get your response. What is your general response to critics and their view of your work?
What is my general response?
Yeah. I mean, find it sometimes discomforting, or do you find it reassuring? Or
rather than admiring and doing otherwise, I deplore and do otherwise. I would like the good opinion of others, but there's not really much I can do about it.
I can say the same. Do.
I wish that I received deeper thought from critics and evaluators. it always seems a little superficial.
Here's a Facebook comment Latoya just delivered to me. Dave asks, while you were a teacher, how did you inspire and exercise a muscle in some way that may not like poetry, and was it successful?
Well, in answer to that, I didn't teach poetry.
Composition teacher, yeah.
I was a composition teacher, and I did teach aspects of poetry in the sense that I spent a lot of time on vocabulary, which, you know, those really are the building blocks of a poem, you know, words. So I tried to breed a great deal of enthusiasm and curiosity regarding language and a sense of the endless possibilities and wealth that they could possess in language, in having words. And I also encouraged metaphor, I mean, in the sense that whenever you're writing, if you can reach out and make an analogy, make a metaphor or simile, you have a richer way of communicating anything that you're talking about.
Think you inspired any poets, or did you inspire any poets?
I don't know.
You may find out after this program. Kay, always good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Again, Kay Ryan's new book is called Erratic Facts, and she will appear at Book Passage, Corte Madera, tonight at 7 o'clock, and also at Mrs. Dalloway's in Berkeley, Thursday, October 22nd at 7:30. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening, and you can always let us know what you think about Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Irene Gucci, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Suki Lewis. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.